It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Endometriosis is a gynecological disease that affects about 10% of women and teen girls around the world. For many people dealing with the condition, it can be painful, disruptive, and debilitating. But despite being relatively common, it often takes endometriosis patients as long as 6 to 10 years to get a diagnosis, sometimes longer still to find treatment options that work. A new documentary called Below the Belt shares the stories of four women whose lives have been disrupted by endometriosis and who are seeking effective treatment. Here's one of them, Jenna, a registered nurse in Los Angeles, who was interviewed for the documentary.
For years now, I've been sent to every specialist that makes sense based on my symptoms, OBGYNs, pulmonologists, cardiologists. They don't see a problem based on their specialty. No one's looking at the big picture. And so now, what am I supposed to do to get better?
I thought that maybe I'm dying or I have some kind of rare disease. But then I go online and find that millions of women are going through exactly what I'm going through.
The first time that I was told it could be endometriosis, I'd never even heard of it.
Our next guests say that more funding and research is needed to get better diagnosis and treatment of the condition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one have endometriosis? Has it been tough to get a diagnosis, to find care and treatment? What questions do you have about the disease? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Shannon Cohn is a documentary producer and director. Her new PBS film, Below the Belt, follows the stories of four women diagnosed with endometriosis. Shannon, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And Dr. Camille Ladani is director of the Minimally Invasive Gynecological Surgery Section for the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, who specializes in endometriosis and chronic pelvic pain. Dr. Ladani, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Ladani, can you start us off with a basic definition of endometriosis and what it looks like for women suffering from it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a general diagnosis is when you have the presence of viable and estrogen-sensitive endometrial-like cells that are found outside of the uterus. Once they're there, they can implant into various tissues, they can grow, and they can cause a very widespread inflammatory response. People present with very different symptoms and degree of symptoms, but a large proportion of patients will present with pain. Some people have infertility, some will have abnormal bleeding patterns, some will have various gastrointestinal symptoms, and others will have fatigue, as well as mental health symptoms such as depression and anxiety.
And Shannon, in Below the Belt, you share four other people's stories. This is also, I understand, your story. Can you talk a little bit about your own experience with endometriosis and trying to get it diagnosed?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, Below the Belt and our previous film, Into What, come from a very personal place. I do have endometriosis. I first had symptoms at 16, yet I didn't hear the word endometriosis until 13 years later. So 13 years of really chasing symptoms and meeting with different specialists and my pediatrician and primary care provider, my school nurse, using their best efforts, really trying to help me find answers, but no one knew really what was, you know, going on. No one put the pieces together. So, and Below the Belt in particular came, you know, the impetus behind it came after I was very fortunate, I have two young daughters. And yet they have a 7 times increased risk. There is a 7 times increased genetic risk among sisters and between mothers and daughters. And when I learned this, I decided that, you know, let's use film. Let's use film as a means to change this.
Dr. Ladani, what are some of the obstacles that lead to patients having, in some cases, years to get a diagnosis?
Absolutely. I think initially patients are told by various people that perhaps their symptoms are normal, that it's just something that they have to accept and just bear through. I think it can also be challenging to talk about some of the very personal symptoms that they encounter. And so finding providers that they can really trust, that will really listen to them and help them to feel heard. And then I think once they do present, because patients with endometriosis present in so many different ways with symptoms that can overlap with other conditions, oftentimes providers don't realize. We now have society guidelines that tell us that even though we need surgery as the gold standard for diagnosis, we don't need that to begin treatment and to move forward with that presumed diagnosis to try to start, you know, treating those symptoms.
Shannon, in Below the Belt, we heard there Jenna talking about feeling shocked that she had never heard of endometriosis, even as a nurse herself. Can you talk about the obstacles people faced, the people in your documentary and others face in trying to navigate the system and get that diagnosis, even when they have a lot of medical training themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, and Dr. LaDani hits the nail on the head. There are so many obstacles. I say, you know, endometriosis is a perfect awful storm of so many things. It's about, you know, menstrual taboo and societal taboo of talking about below the belt, you know, issues in women. It's about gender bias. It's about racial bias. It's about institutional and financial barriers to care. And these are all issues I think that everyone can identify with. It's something that we all struggle with. What does it mean if we're relegated to subpar treatments because we can't, you know, we don't have the financial resources to seek, you know, the best care, quote unquote, and that's things that the film, you know, investigates.
We are talking about endometriosis, a new documentary out from filmmaker Shannon Cohn. With us, also with us, Dr. Camille LaDani from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. LaDani, I learned in the documentary and from reading up on some of your work, the preferred treatments for endometriosis have changed, it seems like, quite a bit over the years. What did we used to do? What is our first line best treatment right now?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, unfortunately, we haven't made nearly as much progress as we would like. And so we are unable to really, truly individualize care as much as we would like to as providers. So when we think about that presumed diagnosis where we start treating people, we still utilize hormonal suppression a lot. We still believe that endometriosis responds to the hormones that our body produces naturally. So we do still use hormonal suppression, but I think that what's really important is evaluating the whole patient, you know, thinking about the symptoms that they have at that time and what are their goals at that time in their life, and trying to tailor how we approach those symptoms and not just necessarily only use hormonal suppression. So we want to think about other chronic overlapping pain conditions. We really want to be collaborating because if they have GI symptoms, can we garner help from our GI professionals? Are we utilizing pain psychology? Are we utilizing pelvic floor physical therapy? Are we utilizing surgery when it's time to do so? You know, are our patients trying to plan for a family? So it's just very, very important that we're communicating with what their goals are and then tailoring those treatments at that time, whether it's medical management versus surgical management.
And Shannon, one of those treatments Dr. LaDani just mentioned ends up being a part of the story for I think all of the women you follow, trying to get a particular kind of effective endometrial surgery, and then finding that their insurance does not cover that. Can you talk about the financial hit these women were taking?
Absolutely. I mean, like Dr. LaDani says, you know, it's really such an individual disease and the treatment protocols vary widely. But yes, in the film, there a subject that does try to access a type of surgery called excision surgery, which is by many considered the gold treatment, which is where excision or lesions of endometriosis are excised or removed from the body. The issue is that many providers who perform this type of surgery operate out of network. So if a patient would like this type of surgery and picks a provider that is in private practice, for example, a lot of times they have to pay out of pocket. And unfortunately, that's a financial barrier for too many. And, you know, they're using credit cards. They're using savings to access this type of surgery, which is evidence of, you know, a larger problem, a larger broken system that we all, I think, can identify with.
That's Shannon Cohn, documentary producer and director of the new film Below the Belt. Also with us, Dr. Camille LaDani, director of the Minimally Invasive Gynecologic Surgery Section at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about endometriosis, a gynecological disease affecting about 1 in 10 women and girls around the world, why it can be tough to get a diagnosis and get effective care. Coming up, we'll look at research, how much investment we have and haven't made on endometriosis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you, about your life? If you've been dealing with endometriosis, what have your experiences been like navigating the medical system to get a diagnosis, to get some kind of treatment? Have you joined support groups on social media? What has helped you? Join in with your experiences, your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about endometriosis, the diagnosis and care of endometriosis, with Dr. Camille Ladani from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and filmmaker Shannon Cohn, director of a new PBS documentary about endometriosis called Below the Belt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've dealt with endometriosis in your life or that of a loved one, and you're willing to share the story, if you're willing to talk about it with us, we would love to hear from you. Where did you find out about it? Have you looked on social media and gotten some inspiration on avenues to pursue? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Shannon, part of the goal of your documentary, it seems like, is to get people talking about endometriosis. You point out in the film that, you know, we're not even willing to talk about periods and menstruation, much less a condition like endometriosis. Are you seeing that change, though?
Absolutely. I do. I have such great, like, you know, hope with our new generations, really breaking the taboo around, you know, talking about menstrual health and periods. And I, you know, like I said, I have two young daughters, one's 15, and I maybe it's because I'm her mother, but at the same time, like, she will talk with her friends about her period. Like, she talks about what she's going to have for lunch. So she'll probably be mortified that I'm sharing that, but maybe not, you know, maybe not, but because I just see, you know, the tide, so to speak, is changing, and thank goodness.
Dr. Ladani, part of the documentary talks about research funding for endometriosis compared to other common conditions. It seems like there's not a lot. What would you hope to see when it comes to research priorities?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. It's so challenging. I mean, what we see right now is a lot of really small projects. And unfortunately, when we have these smaller projects, it's hard to combine those efforts. And so I think that coming together, we work a lot on like multi-institutional projects, trying to get larger numbers of people involved, because, you know, I agree with Shannon, patients are so interested in talking about this. I mean, my patients tell me all the time, if you have a project, I will do it. Just tell me where and when to be. So it's just a matter of trying to continue the efforts, helping people to understand how important this is and how much it's impacting the quality of their life, because there's just so much bias, especially when it comes to pain. And so it's easy for some of these people to just really be disregarded. But I think that if we can get more numbers, then we can start to get more information so that we can really start to individualize care in a meaningful way.
And Shannon, that's one kind of success story in your documentary, an effort to get more funding from Congress for endometriosis. Now, one of your patients, one of the patients you follow, goes to Washington and testifies. She has kind of an inside connection. Her grandpa was the late Senator Orrin Hatch. Good news, I guess, more funding, but bad news, that's what it takes? Like, somebody has to be that personally affected to put this before the Senate?
Right. Well, you know, unfortunately, that seems to be, you know, to be the way a lot of things work, you know, and I think a lot of listeners probably won't be surprised by that. But, you know, at the same time, you know, when something becomes personal for anyone, I mean, it's a human experience. We obviously care about the people we love, and when they're negatively affected, we're, of course, going to care about the larger issue at play. And that's what happened with Senator Hatch. He saw his granddaughter suffer immensely and said, okay, I see the human toll of this disease. Let's do something about it. And fortunately, he knew that that would take a bipartisan effort. He reached out to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who obviously is a Democrat senator from Massachusetts, and really has helped us, you know, put together this really great bipartisan coalition of partners on Capitol Hill to say, hey, you know what, we all care about women's health. We care about this condition and how it affects not only on a personal but also societal level. And it's time to do something about it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Melanie is with us in La Crosse. Melanie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Melanie?
Well, about 30 years ago, I had endometriosis pretty severely, and my lung collapsed. And so I was hospitalized for 9 days and had my lung lining removed. And it was because endometriosis had perforated my diaphragm and entered my lung. It's quite unusual.
Melanie, well, I'm glad you're here to tell us about that. That sounds very serious. Thank you so much for sharing that. Dr. Ladani, now I know endometriosis, as I understand it, mostly is affecting things in the area of the uterus, but it can spread to other organs. It sounds like that happened to Melanie. How common is that?
Yeah, it's certainly, thankfully, and I'm so sorry you went through that. You know, thankfully, it's not as common for it to progress like that, but absolutely can. And so I think that as providers, it's so important for us to really think about these symptoms. You know, we tend to focus on one body area, but we have to pay attention to what else is going on. And, you know, I know I try to really pay attention to, do people have symptoms that are cyclic? Do they respond, you know, kind of in a monthly pattern in a similar way that other more traditional menstrual cycle symptoms might happen? And really pay attention to that and really work with other providers and other specialties to identify these more rare and potentially very dangerous situations.
Melanie, thanks again for sharing that experience. And Shannon, that strikes me as another goal of your documentary, to get that diagnosis earlier so that we don't have extreme cases like Melanie where something could actually start damaging other organs.
Absolutely. I mean, a couple of the different initiatives we have going with the film, of course, is first widespread awareness, which is one reason that it's, you know, premiering on PBS. And we're doing an international rollout over the next coming months so that, you know, everybody understands about endometriosis. But a second aspect is really working with frontline providers, those people in position, school nurses, pediatricians, primary care providers, ER providers, so that when people go into these settings and share these symptoms, right away, these providers think, oh, right, this could be endometriosis. And girls, you know, hear the word at 13 instead of 23 or 33.
Dr. Ladani, obviously endometriosis is on your radar. What are you hoping to see when it comes to what Shannon was just talking about, getting the word out to other medical care providers to hopefully spot this a little earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes into just goals of community efforts with education to patients and families and providers. My goal is to see more, you know, more cohesive collaboration, because I think that unfortunately in our training, we know each of our specific individual areas. I myself, you know, don't know as much, of course, about the, you know, the pulmonary system. And so unfortunately, patients end up just getting bounced around from provider to provider, which is just not a very cohesive way to care for these folks. And so what I would love to see is just more collaboration, even within my personal system here, so that we can more efficiently take care of these patients.
Shannon, something I don't want to miss from the documentary Below the Belt is, you know, endometriosis will look a little different from one person to another, but for the people you follow, in many cases, this is really debilitating and life-changing. Can you talk about some of the experiences you saw from the women you worked with?
Absolutely. I mean, we really thought it was important to show a wide variety of experiences with ages, races, socioeconomic statuses, so that people understand that endometriosis can affect everyone in a different way. And just quickly, everyone who's listening right now is actually affected by endometriosis, whether they realize it or not, either directly or indirectly. It's just a fact. It's just so pervasive. But with the four characters, the four subjects in the film, you know, one is affected. She doesn't really have symptoms as much, but then her fertility is compromised. And she was told early in her 20s, you know, she will never have children. So really going on that journey with her to see what that means. What does that mean when you, you know, are told something like that at such a young age? And for other, like Jenna, who you mentioned earlier, who's a healthcare provider herself and never heard of it, gone to the ER many times with symptoms, yet she never hears the word. And I will say that something we go into that I think is something to note is she is a woman of color, is a registered nurse, and she felt compelled to bring her partner, who's male, who is actually a software programmer, into the doctor's appointments for her because she recognized that she was taken more seriously when he was in the room, and almost to the point where she would always let him speak for her. And so what does that say when someone obviously so educated, so capable, is letting a partner speak for her on a condition that's happening to her body?
Dr. Ladani, can you share some advice for someone who's listening thinking, maybe I have endometriosis? What kind of information, what kind of preparation might they have to come into that first appointment with a doctor, or maybe that appointment with a specialist?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I always tell my patients that, you know, any time that they're willing to create a diary of symptoms to help identify any patterns, timing, associations, anything like that, so that they have that information there with them. I think it can be very emotional, you know, when they're trying to garner all of this energy to think of everything that they can in this very long journey. So doing some of that work ahead of time so that they can really just feel heard during that visit is important. I always tell people to remember that this is a process. You know, unfortunately, since we cannot cure this disease, it's often not straightforward and it will change over time. And so I tell them, just remember that, you know, any given time, it can change, it can get better. You know, what they're feeling does not have to be forever, and that we can continue to work together to make these changes. And so just to advocate for themselves, you know, to work together with their provider.
And we'll leave it there. Dr. Ladani, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for doing this.
And Shannon, thanks for sharing your documentary with us.
Of course. Thank you. It's been an honor.
Been talking to Shannon Cohn, documentary producer and director of the PBS Below the Belt that we've been talking about. It's about endometriosis, and Dr. Camille Ladani, director of the Minimally Invasive Gynecologic Surgery Section at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. They join us for a closer look at endometriosis, an often painful and debilitating disease that affects an estimated 10% of women and teen girls worldwide. Difficult to get a diagnosis in a timely fashion, too. Still time for you to share your story, if you're willing, on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Here in Wisconsin, we've been watching news of the wildfires in Maui in the aftermath of Hurricane Idalia from a distance. That can make us feel concerned, of course, for the people affected. We might also feel helpless in the face of so much destruction. But there are ways that you can contribute to disaster relief efforts. Our next guest is a disaster relief researcher. She has advice about what we can do as individuals to help affected communities in the aftermath of a catastrophic event. And she'll share her years of research on how we can learn from disasters and prepare as communities for the next one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been caught in the middle of a disaster, natural or otherwise? What kind of things helped you the most in the hours, days, and months afterwards? Do you contribute to disaster relief efforts? Do you have thoughts or questions about how communities can be ready for the next disaster, whatever it might be? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Tricia Wachtendorf is a professor of sociology and director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. Tricia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
First, can we talk a little bit about your work? You actually have gone to places in the aftermath of disasters, trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. Can you talk a little bit about what you're trying to do?
Sure. So our center has been studying disasters for 60 years, and there is a strong research community around this country that is interested not only in the aspects that lead to disaster, but how people respond. How organizations coordinate with each other or some of the challenges associated with that, and things that we can do to recognize that people experience disasters in different ways.
For someone far from the disaster scene, as we've been in Wisconsin with the Maui wildfires, the hurricane in Florida, what are some of the most effective ways to make a contribution to help from afar?
In the disaster research and management communities, there's actually something that we often refer to as the second disaster, the influx of ad hoc goods into a disaster zone. And here's why. Helping a neighbor in a house fire is going to be very different than helping a community impacted by disaster. If my neighbor has a house fire, I might bring over clothes, but I know what sizes they have, and I can take back with me what they don't need. I can ask about their allergies if I'm taking them dinner, and I can ask them what they need right then and give it to them in an hour or in a day. That is strikingly different for a community impacted by disaster. There can be a delay in transportation, difficulty storing goods. And often, unfortunately, what we see is the influx of clothes, goods that are not sorted or damaged. People might get supplies that they needed in the first day or two, but by the time it gets there, it's a week or so later, and it ends up being a huge logistical challenge for them.
So what's my best bet, as opposed to, you know, going through my clothes closet and seeing what I can give up, or going through the canned food in the pantry? What would be a more effective way to give to help?
It's much more effective to give a cash donation to an organization you trust, either a national organization, or even in looking at some of the community groups that may routinely help in an area. It could be a school, it could be a daycare, it could be a social service organization, a community group. Those kinds of organizations that we look to in our neighborhoods all the time, those are going to struggle when a disaster happens as well. And those are the people who know the residents the best, who can step in and to provide assistance. One thing that we know as well is that it can be a little bit difficult for people to give cash if they're tight on a budget. So one of the interesting cases that we saw after the Haiti earthquake, I came across a parking lot sale by a faith-based organization. They at the time recognized that their parishioners didn't have a lot of cash to give. They were told that giving clothes would be a bad idea after the Haiti earthquake. And so they had a parking lot sale. They took those clothes, they had a sold it back to other people in the community. And then rather than pushing those supplies on to a country that wasn't able to accept it or didn't need it at the time or would cost money to send it there, they actually sent them the cash that they earned from that sale. So there's sometimes creative ways that we can recognize it can be difficult to give cash, but at the same time, recognizing the real needs of those impacted communities.
I know sometimes when I've wanted to give after a disaster, there's an urge in my head to say, okay, I want to make sure this money goes to the people who just had that hurricane. I want it earmarked for that and that only. Does that make life difficult for relief organizations if I try to do that?
It actually does, especially when there are several disasters that happen one on top of the other. You might recall back when Hurricane Harvey happened, there were several other hurricanes that occurred later. A lot of people gave after Hurricane Harvey and earmarked those particular donations. But then that makes it difficult for an organization to say, look, we have enough here, but this is a community that really needs help. We can't spend it though. We can't direct those dollars to those in need because someone earmarked it for one particular hurricane and not the other. If it's great if you want to indicate your preference that it goes to disaster relief, but it's really important to give flexibility for those organizations so they can shift gears and respond to people's actual need.
Talking to Tricia Wachtendorf, Professor of Sociology, Director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware, talking about how we can best help people who have experienced disasters far away, how to prepare for disasters in any community as well. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your experiences, whether it's philanthropy to help people after a disaster, whether you've participated in a local effort to be ready for tornadoes, floods, fires, you name it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tricia, let's talk about preparing communities for potential disasters. What are some of the things that, again, everyday people can get involved in their own community?
Yeah, on the community level, there's often a community emergency response team that operates out of your local or your state emergency management agency. Those are great ways to get involved before a disaster strikes, consider the kinds of skills that you might have, and really get integrated into that network. If a disaster happens, there are volunteer organizations active in disasters that have a seat at the table in emergency operation centers. Sometimes those are good organizations to reach out to. If we are in our own community, that is a situation where we often know those needs better than anyone. One of the things that we know as well, that you're more likely to be saved after an earthquake by your neighbors, by your family and friends who know you're in a building, compared to someone coming from a great deal of distance away. That holds true on all fronts. We have skills that we have resources that we might not think of as being important in a disaster response. We did some work looking at the boat evacuation after 9/11, and there were tugboat operators, ferry boat operators who came in, who saw a need, who had a vessel, and were able to evacuate by people by boat where there was no plan in place. We see the same thing with the Cajun Navy time and time again. So thinking about the skills that you have, the connections that you have in your neighborhood, and ways that you can tie into those organizations that are helping so that you can get the information about where those needs are.
I wonder, those boat rescues were great things. I wonder about, you know, the temptation like, oh, I want to rush in and help people. Well, if I don't have skills, if I don't know what I'm doing, am I just making the situation worse? How do people self-evaluate in that way, whether to stay away and that's going to help more, or I can actually help here?
You're absolutely right that there's a tough balance to strike. It is best when we are acting in some capacity where we have skills. You certainly wouldn't want me taking a boat out to save anyone, because I would just get my own self in trouble. But at the same time, if I am operating in areas that I have skills in, if I'm an educator and I'm used to working with small children, who better to potentially volunteer at a shelter to provide some assistance? Again, that is where some of those organizations that coordinate volunteers, those volunteer organizations active in disasters, is really important. And especially if you're coming to an area that you're not from. There are going to be aspects of the culture. Disasters can change the geography, the way you get around. So if you are just converging on an area and you're unfamiliar with it, and you don't have a connection to help you get integrated, that can pose a lot of challenges.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Waseca. Chris, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, we've had two disasters that have happened here locally. In 2013 and 2019, we had flooding that was quite severe, and I helped out with that. I think we ended up with 5.5 feet of water in our basement in 2013. And then I've been active in Civil Air Patrol. I'm retired now. But we did air, ground, search and rescue, disaster relief, looking for missing persons, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I did that for 25 years.
Wow. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that experience and for all the work you've done. Tricia, what are some of the contacts we can make, the connections we can make now before a disaster? We might not all be in Civil Air Patrol, but so we can contribute like Chris did when the need arises.
Well, again, some of the connections are through CERT teams. As Chris mentioned, as being retired in a certain capacity, there are sometimes organizations like the Medical Reserve Corps that takes in volunteers with a medical background. There's other ones as well, where if you have a skill, they'll really match you around a particular area of expertise. Building those connections in our community. So I'm not sure if Chris's contacts know the wonderful expertise brought to the table, but knowing somebody who knows someone else can be really essential. It might be knowing somebody who has a generator and you didn't know that, but your friend does, or somebody you serve on a community group or your kid's little league team remembers you saying something. Building those connections is really valuable.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. We're talking to Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology, director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. She's here to tell us how we can help communities affected by disaster, how we can prepare for the worst in our own neighborhoods. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a plan in place for when disaster comes? Are you or have you been a volunteer on some kind of disaster response team? What questions do you have for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology, director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware, talking to her about disaster response, how we can contribute as individuals, how to prepare for future disasters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. Tricia, before we go back to our callers, wanted to bring up the issue of communication. There are always questions about, you know, how local governments and others can communicate risk to the public and when the public should sit up and take notice and say, oh yeah, I'm the public. I should be listening to this message. What do we know about what works best?
One of the key things to keep in mind for communities is to use multiple ways of reaching the public. Some of us are active on social media, but is that social media Facebook or is it Instagram or is it TikTok? Some of us are more likely to get our information from radio or television or print news. And then there's others who are really relying on, let's say, leaders in their faith community or community groups or government officials. So using a multi-prong approach is important, and making sure that that information is consistent so that someone isn't hearing one thing from one person and then reading something else that is different. That consistency, being specific, being clear about what people should do, those are key aspects in communication.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Austin is with us in Lafarge. Austin, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to share a great avenue for people that are maybe a little nerdy or like to practice with electronics and technology, that amateur radio, ham radio, is a great skill to acquire and get involved with your local clubs and local disaster relief groups. It's well documented during Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, and dozens of cases of ham radio being the backbone of critical communication infrastructure. And it's a great hobby otherwise when you're not participating in things like that. So it's a sort of a dying hobby, but would certainly be a great way for young people to practice their science and technology and also learn a neat way to be involved in times like that.
Austin, thanks a lot for the suggestion. That's not my particular brand of nerdery, but my dad and my younger brother were big into ham radio for a while. And Tricia, I think about that and I worry about the decline of amateur radio because sometimes if the internet is down, if our power is down, that is a way for people to communicate across long distances.
Yeah, and I don't have one either. But I think your caller makes a really good point about helping doesn't necessarily mean being on the ground where a disaster happens, that there are ways to get involved and provide assistance, be it through ham radio operation, which he's absolutely right, can play a really important role in disaster response and communication. By actually setting up a communication system through various social media or setting up a website for an organization. There's lots of remote activity that can actually be much more helpful to those on the ground than joining them in person.
Austin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tricia, that reminds me of the risk of social media misinformation about disasters. I think there have always been false rumors that follow any major disaster. They are super in your face on social media. Pictures that are not accurate representations of what's going on, rumors of disease outbreaks, things like that. How big a problem is bad information spreading about any particular disaster?
It is a challenge. It primarily, we see a lot of it in not the immediate time period, but you know, a couple of hours or a couple of days or weeks out. What can also happen is information that was correct at some time for some disaster gets recycled for another disaster. So the image that you see might actually be from a hurricane, but it's from a hurricane from 3 years ago, or a situation that emerged is not from this event in this area, but it's from something else. Sometimes that is misinformation, someone trying to cause trouble. But a lot of times it's also this idea of disinformation that you talk about, where people are well-intended, they're trying to share information, they haven't checked the source of it, and it can lead to real challenges in people trying to make sense about what to do next. Making sure that if you are sharing information that you've checked it before you do that is really important to help others.
Let's go back to our callers. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi. I've been involved in some minor disasters, but the commonality was that folks were looking for someone to lead. They didn't know what to do. Time passed. One was a medical situation, fortunately not deadly, but minutes passed. No one seemed to take hold and coalesce the group. So I think volunteers with some knowledge can fill that role unexpectedly anywhere.
Vivian, thanks for the call. Trisha, are there ways we can be prepared to step up and help out and bring people together in that way?
I think that part of it is this combination of people who are experienced in disasters or experienced in the area that they're working with, working alongside people who might be engaging in a degree of surge capacity, trying to, they don't know what to do, but they have something that they can offer in that moment. So this combination of recognizing where your skills are and being willing to step up to share that with others. Sometimes the person who knows the most is kind of unassuming. In a disaster, someone might show up in their sweatpants and a t-shirt. They're not necessarily uniformed or looking like a leader. But to understand and really keep an open mind that some of those individuals might bring a wealth of expertise to that response.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. Trisha, one thing I wanted to get into in your research, you talk about social vulnerability as a factor in how people are affected by disasters. How does that work? It may seem obvious, but who is more vulnerable? How can we help deal with that vulnerability?
Sometimes when a disaster happens, we have this assumption that the hurricane or the tornado or the earthquake or the environmental spill doesn't care about our demographics, doesn't care about who we are. And that might be the case, but the community that we live in, the sort of vulnerabilities that we have, do make a huge difference in how we experience that particular disaster event. If my power goes out for a week, I might lose the goods in my fridge. I might be eating a lot of ice cream with my kids just in the hours afterwards. But in general, I'm going to be okay. That is a very different circumstance if I rely on refrigerated medication, if I'm in an electric wheelchair, if I'm on dialysis and need to get into an appointment, if I'm in a bed that requires assistance for me to raise it and lower it to get out of bed, that won't be possible if the power goes out. Thinking about how also that vulnerability changes over time as we engage in preparedness for our own household. Was there a new baby in the home? That's gonna make a difference about what kind of supplies that you need to have together in order to take care of this new member of your household. Do you provide assistance to an elderly parent who lives across town? Is somebody else relying on you? Even thinking about our pets, we might have a carrier where we're able to take one dog at a time to the vet. But if we have to evacuate, like we saw in Maui, very suddenly, very quickly, are we able to get all of our pets out at the same time and transport them? So understanding how our vulnerability, our challenges routinely become exacerbated get worse in a disaster will help us understand how we can prepare our own homes.
Tricia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology and director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. We talked to her about disaster relief, recovery, and preparedness. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, there have been heat waves across the U.S. this summer, but there's also a growing problem in the oceans. Check out Marine Ecosystems and More tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Driving back across the western part of the state on Labor Day, I saw some of the earliest hints of leaves changing colors, just here and there at this point. That was just enough to remind me it's the time of year to check out the fall color forecasts, and I'm not alone on that. At the national level, the Smoky Mountain National Park website has its fall foliage prediction map online covering the whole country. You can fast forward through the coming weeks to see what should be in the store for your travels around the U.S. No surprise, minimal color so far, mostly in the northern part of the country. By the way, this year they're looking for your observations. You can submit your fall color sightings. Here in Wisconsin, you can make fall color travel plans with the Fall Color Report at travelwisconsin.com. They show the latest reports and the estimated peak time to see the best colors in counties and communities around the state. Where do you go for fall colors? Across the country or in your own community? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.